Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 170, from Dream Body to World Work, August 29th, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
World Work is the name of our large group work in conflict resolution.
And World Work is not just about then a small group, but yes, it does. It has an organizational part that works with small and large people sitting around at desks or in an organizational setting. No, it was developed by Dave in order to approach large groups of people who are irritated, upset, angry, or even fighting one another, even dangerously fighting one another. In other words, dealing with psychology should be about dealing with people where they're at, whether they're in a coma or they're in an almost murderous situation. So that's how World Work began.
How do you deal with large groups of people who are upset, angry, or even dangerously fighting one another, or bring someone out of a coma? These and other questions will be addressed by my guests. Dr. Arnold Mindell is a well-known author, Jungian training analyst, workshop leader, and originator of World Work. His wife, Dr. Amy Mindell, is an author in her own right, and the two work very closely together. To learn more about this amazing couple, go to our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Doctors Amy and Arnie Mindell, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for inviting
us. Thank you for having us.
It's my pleasure. As you probably know, I've previously interviewed two of your associates, Dr. Julia Diamond on number 129, for any listeners that might be interested. I interviewed her on process work, and then Dr. Max Schupbach on world work in episode number 133. And I got tantalizing hints from each of them, and I'm still trying to wrap my mind around these huge concepts. And so I thought I better go upstream and get the info straight from the horse's mouth, if you'll pardon the mixed metaphor.
It makes me want to gallop like a horse.
Yeah, good, good. So if you don't mind, I'd like to start out by having you step us through your very interesting biographies. And Arnie, I'll start with you. I believe you were doing graduate work in physics at MIT and then somehow ended up a Jungian training analyst. Can you kind of take us through that?
Well, Dave, I was studying at MIT. I studied applied physics at MIT, and then I was always interested in psychology. And so I was interested in going back to Zurich, where I had spent my junior year in college. And while I was in college, in undergraduate school, I had bumped into the Jungians over there, and they sort of interested me. Mm-hmm. So while I was finishing my master's at MIT, how can I get connected to a research institute there and a PhD institute there at the ETH as an MIT in Switzerland. And so I went over there, and while I was there, I started shifting. I began Jungian analysis, and then I became a Jungian analyst. And I did my PhD then in psychology, and then I rolled into Jungian psychology, and then I went further, but I don't want to go too fast. Am I going at the right pace for you?
Oh, yeah, this is a great pace. And so you got your PhD actually after you were an analyst.
That's right. I became a Jungian analyst, and at the same time as I graduated as a Jungian analyst in 1970, I got my PhD in psychology, and I went on working as a Jungian analyst, as a training analyst then, about 5 years later. And while I was working as a training analyst, I guess part of my biography, really a big part of it, begins at that time. I began process work.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm hoping that in some alternate universe, I'm leading your life. Because, because I started out with a technological set of interests, accepted into university in an electrical engineering program, and then I switched out and ended up going into psychology and became fairly enamored with Jungian psychology, but never went down that path to get the black belt in Jungian analysis.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I that's very interesting. I mean, I thought physics is interesting, Dave. It's wonderful. I still love it, but it, believe it or not, even though the physicist in me studies the universe and nature and what makes nature tick, how does it work, the mind of God, so to speak, Einstein called the intelligence behind nature the mind of, although that still fascinates me, people were even more complicated and more challenging.
Oh, yes.
People and the people world, that's psychology for me, that means psychology, spiritual traditions and things like that, they had less coherence, less understanding. If you work with a person, then you work with this psychology or that psychology. Psychology was too split up for me into parts. So I thought, this is interesting. Let me get into one of these psychologies and let me see where I can go from there.
The pieces are beginning to fall into place for me here a little bit. I think I understand something about you here, that it seems like the physicist in you, I'm thinking of Einstein, who worked to try to get a grand universal theory, you know. And it seems like you're sort of moving in that direction for psychology, you know, starting off with dream body work and moving into larger and larger units of study and practice.
Right.
So it seems like you're
that's just right. Thank you, Dave. That's just exactly right. I mean, my first session as a analysant, as a client in Jungian psychology, I went to Marie-Louise von Franz. She was my analyst.
Oh,
that was
wow.
One of my favorite students. And I said to her, I have some weird feelings. I'm only 21, but I need a lot of help. And she said to me, well, let's look and see what you dreamed last night. And I said to her, Marie-Louise, why are you asking me about last night? Can't you see what you call the unconscious in me right now? And she said, well, Arnie, to tell you the truth, we don't yet know how to do that. And maybe that's part of your story, that you'll find that out. So that was a very big question for me. How do you follow this damn unconscious thing? How is it here right now in the moment? Why do I have to wait till I go to sleep at night? So then I began to try to unfold how the unconscious process.
So that really foreshadowed your work. That really...
Everything. It was all there,
yeah.
Of course.
You know, they say the first dream sort of lays it all out, but for you it wasn't the dream, it was that sort of intuitive reach for what was needed.
That's right. We do say still the first dream is the big thing, and a lot of process people here now are saying, I should speak for myself here, it's in the first 30 or 40 seconds that you see somebody that you can see the parts of the next 20 or 30 years at least.
Wow. Well, Amy, tell us a bit about your background and how you two came to hook up.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, that was very good. Mm-hmm. I was in undergraduate school at Antioch College in Ohio.
Oh, yes.
And I was majoring in dance and theater. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to go into, but I loved the arts. And I had a teacher at the time whose name was Ben Thompson. He was an education teacher.
Wow.
He was fabulous, and he used to talk a lot about Arnie. And he told me what he was doing, and he knew what I was interested in. He said, gee, why don't you go to Zurich and check out what Arnie's doing? And it turned out that Ben was also one of Arnie's teachers at, where was it, at Union Institute, I believe. So he knew both of us and thought I would really like what Arnie was doing and should go find him.
He told me to take a look at her.
So that was good.
I've seen her picture. I could see why you would.
Oh, that's so sweet.
That's right.
Thank you. And, now I forgot everything. So I went to Zurich and I met Arnie and I just absolutely loved him and I loved what he was doing. I think I was really, passionate to try to find a way of bringing my movement interests, my theater and arts interests together with psychology and social action and all sorts of things. I wanted a more comprehensive sort of way of viewing the world and working with people. I wanted to work with people, so I was really happy to find him there.
Yeah, so that's something that the two of you share, was that quest for a more comprehensive approach.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I had a similar experience to yours. I didn't go off and marry Arnie, but in various workshops that I was leading, people would say, "Yes, but do you know the work of Arnold Mandel?"
Oh, well, amazing!
So I'm happy to have this opportunity.
Oh, nice
finally.
To have a similar path.
Well, the three of us can always get married in something.
Right, it's one of those other universes.
Right.
Okay, in your Arnie, your early work focused on what you called the dream body. I'm particularly interested in that because I've always been fascinated with dreams. What do you mean by the dream body?
Well, as soon as I got my diploma in Jungian psychology, I have to build up to it like that.
Sure.
As soon as I got my diploma, I said, now I love Jung because, wow, things are meaningful. They're not just problems. And then I got sick, physically sick. I had a bit of a gout attack at the age of 30, which is a very unusual thing. And the doctors, I went to the doctors, and they said, you've got arthritis, you've got gouty arthritis, and you'll have that for the rest of your life. And I said, well, gee, that's a depressing thought.
Yes,
and
right.
They said, sorry, you'll just have to take these pills for the rest. Actually, they were wrong. About 7 or 8 months later, it disappeared. I think it came because it made my big toe hurt, and it made me walk around and start to hobble around and think, how can this be meaningful? This must also have a meaning. What is it?
Mm-hmm.
And, I just pondered. I read all the books on allopathic medicine and all on alternative medicines. All very important, very interesting, but I didn't get the meaning of my problem yet. And then I was working with a priest one day, one of the first times I came across the dream body idea. I was working with this priest, and people knew that in Zurich I was the one to go to at the time. Oh, Arnie, he's interested in somatic stuff. And so a lot of people come to me, and he came to me, and he said, he had had a heart attack, and he was still having Herzstechen, that's stabbing pains in the chest area. So I asked him about his medicines and that he's taking things. He's being taken care of in the normal sense, and he was, but he still had these stabbing pains. So I said, would you be kind enough to pick up something around you and show me what they're like? And he took up one of my pencils, Dave, and he pointed it into the air and made a little bit of a stabbing motion with his right hand. I still remember it. And he stabbed a bit, and he said, ah, and he smiled when he did that.
Huh.
And I said to him, because of my training at the time, well, now that's so interesting, you're smiling. Have you had a dream recently? And the priest said to me, I did. I dreamt about holding a knife. And I said, aha.
Uh-huh.
So you're holding a knife in a dream, and now you're having stabbing pains in your heart area. So I thought, let's drop the allopathic approach for the moment. That means the regular medical approach. Let's drop that. I said to him, Lieber Herr so-and-so, I said, dear sir, please go ahead and continue to stab a little bit. And while you're stabbing, just imagine what you could do with that energy. And he said, I could be more direct with folks, and I could, when I give my sermons, I could be more direct.
Wow.
So I wasn't very interested in the sermon. I wasn't too interested in the sermons, but I was very interested in the human being behind the sermons. He needed to be more direct and say what he wanted to. So that's the psychological thing. But, Dave, the amazing thing is that his heart chest pains felt better.
Yes.
And they didn't return, and he didn't complain about them. And a week later, he had tried to do this, and he felt better. And I said, now that's interesting. The dream about the stabbing and the body about the sensation of stabbing pains. Dream body. What you dream, you experience a little bit in your body. And what you experience in your body is in your, that's a dream body.
Okay.
Okay, so that's a dream body in a nutshell.
Yeah. You know, I was struck that that sort of insight came out of the mild physical illness that you had. You know, it reminds me of the whole thing about the wounded healer and so on, and how adversity or illness can be a springboard into some new creative direction.
Oh, it was definitely one of the most wonderful things. That it was a healing thing to have been sick for those months, definitely.
Yes. Now, I'm going to be asking you questions relating it to other approaches, and I don't in any way mean to suggest that what you're doing is derivative, but I see elements in other approaches, and so I just want to bounce some of those off of you. I'm sure you're aware of them yourself.
Yeah, well, I say hopefully, yeah. hopefully, because process, my use of the word process, means that if you're a Freudian, there should be times when you're freely associating, but then those things, that Freudian approach happens during any therapy sessions with anybody, freely associating, or you might have a gestalt experience in which you're processing something with your hands like Fritz Perls,
right.
Or you might be talking about an archetype. So all these various things for me, Dave, hopefully they must come together. That's why I call this process work. We're following the unconscious process.
Yes, one of the things that I was struck by, you know, speaking of Freud, because in your Dream Body book, you talk about sort of tapping into, it's as if the unconscious were a stream that's constantly running and kind of tapping into it at various times. And it reminded me of Freud's notion of primary process thinking, which I don't think enough attention is given to these days. It's kind of like that idea got dropped, but to me that seems like it's a fundamental idea.
Wow. Believe it. I found out about the primary Freud's primary process only afterwards when I said that our primary process is the one we primarily identify with. I turned that around.
Uh-huh.
But, yes, it's primary process for me, what are you closest to? So the priest, he was closest to being a sweet guy. In my mind, his secondary process, that means something further from his awareness, that was the direct shooter, the direct stab, so to speak.
Yes, I think of primary process thinking as baby thinking. That's how I talk about it to myself. You know, it's the kind of thought that we engaged in before we had language, and I don't think it goes away. I think it's still down there somewhere, kind of running as a subterranean stream.
Oh, it's not just subterranean. Every time I wake up in the morning, I find myself looking at Amy saying, goo, 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 goo. Baby is right there.
Yeah. Now, you also, in that book, I seem to recall there was considerable discussion about Taoism. Talk a little bit about how you see your work connecting with Taoism.
Oh, now, that's the thing it's a funny thing. It's a big secret. It's not a secret, but it's a kind of it's a deep inner thing. It's something that I really hold to inside.
Yes.
That since I was a little boy and looking out at the skies in the evening, it would get dark, and I would be fascinated. Why is it getting dark? my father said, the sun goes down. And I said, really? And then it gets light again, and then it rains, and the seasons change. I was always just amazed that everything changes. And then right in the beginning of my Jungian studies, I came across and needed to study a specialty, and it was became Taoism, the idea that you can't really define the very essence of the Tao. It's something that's almost inevitable. And so I just spend a lot of time myself in a kind of empty, open mind state, when I can, not always, that Tao that can't be said,
mm-hmm.
and that watching then the Tao that can be said come into life, changes happen, signals happen, they occur in channels, and I can follow them in, with people. So Taoism plays a very, very central role, has always played a central role in everything that I've done.
You know, that's interesting. As I heard you talking about the Tao as the thing that can't be named, as having that ineffable quality, one of the tie-ins, I think, to Jungian thought is the archetype, which ultimately can't be nailed down. We can only sort of gesture in its general direction.
Definitely. Jung was, he would have been thrilled. I arrived in Zurich, it's funny, kind 6 days after he died. And so I've always felt very close to him. Mm-hmm. The whole ineffable thing that you're bringing back was also part of his unus mundus, the one world of alchemy that's behind everything, something that you can't put your finger on exactly. It's got this stuff, it's like a unification layer in the background of reality.
Yes. Now, yeah. that story that you told about working with that priest, it did have very much the feeling of Gestalt therapy. And maybe you hadn't even been exposed to Gestalt therapy at that point.
Not at that time. It was 1970, and not yet. I hadn't yet found out about Esalen and Gestalt and everything. That came later.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Because
I saw his hands moving, and he was showing me, he was acting something out.
Yes.
So it made obvious sense from Jung's active imagination. I had come from Jung's active imagination, where you look at an image, you talk to images, but just talking to images was boring. I wanted to have more fun, so I asked people to act their images out. And then I found out later, well, listen, Fritz Perls and the whole group of folks have been doing that for a while.
Yeah, you know, I'm not aware of Fritz Perls giving Jung any credit. I could be wrong about this, but his approach did seem to have a lot in common with the idea of active imagination.
Definitely.
Yes.
Definitely.
Do you see any connection between the dream body and what the Aborigines refer to as dream time? I'm reaching there. They just sound similar, so I'm... I'm wondering.
Well, the Aboriginal people of Australia, I'm going to speak about mainly as east coast, their dream time is an earth-based psychology.
What?
Earth-based.
Oh, earth-based, yes.
Earth-based, that means when they talk about the dream time, they're not talking about dreaming like the European schools of psychology. That's mainly visual, the dreaming for most of the early European psychologies, at least, was visual. But they're talking about the earth. The dream time is a power emanating from the trees, you know, the trees and the grass and the ground, and appearing in form of figures like the great rainbow serpent and other things like that. And so they're closer, I feel much closer to them in some ways than I do today to just the European psychologies because of their earth basis of everything.
Yes. So if I saw you two doing dream work, what would it look like? How would it be different than, say, Gestalt work with a dream, if at all?
Well, you want to speak about that?
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, that depends entirely upon the person. Someone says, I want to work on a dream, and then I'll say, what a great idea. what dream would you like to work on? But then, just recently, one of my clients started coughing. So I said, what's happening? The person said, I can't talk. I have I have a little bit of, my throat is sore, I have a cold or something like that. And so I said, well, that's wonderful, let's go with that. And then go into your cough, and the cough person got quiet, and then got red in the face. And I said, you're getting red in the face, what's happening there? And the person said, I can't talk. I said, what can you do? Do you want to do anything? I can only move. The person got up and danced a really strange and wonderful dance. I followed the person's process in the dance movement, and the arms were coming out in a very, the elbows, I mean, were coming out in a very, let me use the word, it's not quite right, but a very rough or aggressive way. And then I said, that's good. Let's see what... That's a fact that was secondary for me, the arms coming out like that. The person began to put her feet on the ground, boom, 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 boom. And then I said, that's interesting. What are you doing? She said, I'm beating a drum. And then she started to talk about her dream. Last night, she said, I had a dream in which I was beating a drum. And I can't say the details. I don't want to give the person stuff away. But I was beating a drum, and there was a dance happening. And I said, okay, did you get it? And she said, I got it. Mm-hmm. She understood the meaning of her dream because she was experiencing it.
Uh-huh. So
it happened first through her coughing. Then she was in the proprioceptive channel. And then she was in a movement channel, kinesthetic. She was moving and watching her signals there. And then the dream work doesn't necessarily... You can interpret the dream first in process work and then discover that the dream is like a check on the work that you did.
Mm-hmm. Or a visual description of the dreaming process, as Arnie was saying before, that we dream at night, but there's, and you were saying before, David, too, that there's a dreaming process that's always happening that we can step into any time and try to follow it through its various sensory-oriented channels and signals, and that often will lead back to the actual dream itself. Although there are times when we'll focus on the dream, the actual images, if that's what the person's interested in.
Okay. There's the Jungian concept of amplification as a way of working with dreams and symbols, and I gather that you've applied that in your work.
And answer that, the first one up, that the dream work itself is what's happening. In other words, that's what Amy and I were trying to say there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, we don't just focus on the dream and its symbols and the associations.
But you're focusing on what's unfolding in the moment.
What's exactly, happening? Yeah. What's happening in the moment is the interpretation of the dream.
Yes. Okay. Okay.
Sorry, and I was so excited about that. We didn't hear your next question.
Oh, I was trying to get something in about amplification because I noticed you took that Jungian idea and you apply it to to your work in some novel ways.
Yes. Yes. Like, for example, that the situation I was telling you about where this woman was moving about with her arms, and then instead of amplifying a symbol let's say, drumming by talking about the drum as a symbol and Native American symbolism and whatever, took the idea of a symbol and amplified it not just through mythological or intellectual information, but through actually amplifying the signal in which an experience is happening. A little movement, can you make that bigger? Or if we work with somebody in a coma and we see just a little tiny, tiny eyebrow movement, amplification there means I'll say to the person, whoa, I see your eyebrow moving. I know it's moving. You're there, I guess. And then you watch for other signals that come up. That's coma work. I didn't want to get too far too fast.
Yeah, I want to get to the coma work. but before we get there, I've got some other questions here. I read an interview that you did and read that you're uncomfortable with the concept of, quotes, healing these days. If you're not doing healing, what is it you're doing when you work with individuals?
Well, I have to tell the whole truth. And that is, if someone's really interested in getting healed, I won't say I'm not interested in, I won't hurt their feelings about that, but in my very deepest feelings, people, I don't think, need to get healed. They need to just catch on, follow their process. I don't see people as sick. The body is not only sick. That's one level of things, and I do accept that, and it's fine to heal all of that and everything. But that's, I don't feel that people are sick. So
what about the symptoms that they're trying to get rid of, though, that they so dearly want to be rid of?
And I don't blame them. I also, if I have a headache, get rid of that damn thing. I'm with those people entirely. However, it, the deepest part of me, I feel, no, it's, I don't look at them as pathology that they're just going to get rid of, but as something trying to emerge that's meaningful, the unconscious process. That's why I call it, what I do, I feel that we do, and lots of us people doing in many schools, is process work.
Maybe I can jump in. I'm thinking of the difference of healing or following somebody's process and what they get out of that. And it, for some reason in the moment, reminds me of a woman that we worked with many years ago who has cerebral palsy. And she suffers a lot from that. She has a hard time speaking. She has an incredible hard time walking and moving. She has to use a huge amount of energy just to go from here to there and to concentrate. And but she would like to be healed in a way, because it's a really, it's an incredible weight upon her to just to do her daily life. And so we talked about what might be helpful in the ordinary sense and what she's done medically, and then tried to follow her natural process, let's say, her the signals and experiences that she was having that maybe didn't go along with the normal way that she was supposed, she thought she would like to operate and be in the ordinary world. And when she followed, she ended up following all of her spastic movements and ended up moving sideways and going on the ground, not trying to make herself walk normally. And she got up finally.
She was courageous.
She was extremely courageous. She was very shy and scared of that at first. And but once she went into that, she ended up, to make a long story short, doing a kind of dance, and a rhythm came out of her movement. And then she started laughing and singing, and it was in the middle of a seminar, and she asked everybody to sing with her. And there was like something like a party came out of that. And she said, oh, this is what I've longed for my whole life, is some connection with everybody, but I feel so isolated and alone all the time, and people look at me like I'm weird and all of that. And this is what she was looking for. And in her childhood dream, she had dreamt she was with her family in a castle, I believe, having a huge party. So this was when she got in touch with that aspect of herself that loved people and wanted to have joy and parties, sort of dancing with them. She felt much better physically. Her body could relax, and she felt better in the ordinary way, and also she was able to follow her deepest process.
So you could say, would you say she's, mm-hmm. so she had an illness,
mm-hmm.
but another view of the same situation is she had a dance,
yeah.
and a community
and it was,
dance.
It was trying to emerge that is usually suppressed or in trying to be an ordinary woman. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's wonderful. I can see how you're creative background would feed very well into this, Amy. I get the impression that the two of you work together very closely. Amy, can you describe how that interplay works a bit?
Oh, it's wonderful. I think we love working together. We travel a lot, and we do seminars and all kinds of different seminars and different themes, and we work together and play off of one another, have a lot of fun. And I think we bring some similar but some very different qualities that fills out what we do together. It's really beautiful. It's really lucky, I think, to have a relationship where we can do that.
I think so, too. And I'm
pretty rare.
I think it's pretty rare. I agree. It's very rare. Mm-hmm. To me, it's the it's kind of the pinnacle of self-improvement. Improvement's the wrong word. I don't know what reaching for.
I need to improve a lot. Help. Yeah.
Vice versa.
Okay.
It's great working together, mm-hmm. and it's really weird. I have to say, you know, we're both trained to work with one another and work on situations and work with people, but we don't, it's just, I think, I don't know, Amy, am I wrong in saying mm-hmm. it's kind of lucky.
Okay.
It just sort of happens.
Yeah.
You think?
Very lucky, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, Arnie, now I can cut you loose on the subject of the comatose patients. I read a bit about your work with comatose patients.
Oh.
What moved you in that direction? You know, most people think, oh, this person's in a coma, forget it.
Mm-hmm. Really? Well, that's it. You know, you see, I was in Zurich, and I was interested in people. I thought, you know, I was trained in psychology, sitting in a chair with another person sitting in another chair, sometimes getting up, but rarely. And I wanted to move around more. And so the whole dream body work took me into movement and body stuff and things of that sort. And most of psychology, Dave, until that time, was about people talking and expressing things mainly in words, though movement would come up also. But then how about working with somebody who's totally knocked out, near death, or in a vegetative or comatose state? So people knew I was interested in all sorts of things, and some of my first clients that I saw were severely ill, and some of them then would approach death, and they would say, come with me, stay with me. And that encouragement, I didn't know anything about working with dying people. I was in my 30s. I was shocked. It was just a great shock to me even to work with somebody who was dying. And then when they went into these quiet, apparently remote states of consciousness where they weren't present, like, for example, one of the clients that I first worked with was just sitting there there was still an oxygen tent at that time. That was the end of the early 70s there in Zurich. She was on oxygen, and people couldn't get her to get out of the coma or die or live. And so I went inside her oxygen tent. That makes you a little bit high when you do that from the oxygen. And I said to her, I can see you're breathing. And then she made a bigger breath. Ha, ha. And I said, ha, I now see you're really breathing. And then I said, because I had a little too much oxygen myself, I was perhaps more excitable than I normally am. And I said to her, you know, people want to know what you're doing in there. Why don't you do something? And she made a big motion, and a kind of no motion. I thought it was a no motion. So I said, okay, no, you don't want to come back. And then she made another motion, and then she said, I don't want, she said in English, she was Swiss German, but she said in English, I don't want to come back. And I said, why not? She says, I have unfinished stuff on the Bahnhof, on the main street in Zurich. She was a businesswoman, apparently. And so suddenly she was talking. And I said, well, it's up to you. If I were you, why don't you finish that stuff up, and then you can do what you want. And to make the story short, she pushed her own oxygen thing aside, and the nurses were all telling her to go back in the oxygen tent and take it easy, but she wanted to get up and leave the hospital. So things like that occurred several times to me, and it really freaked me out, that the person they're much more there than you think. Many people, not everybody, many people. And then I didn't dare write about any of those far-out stories until Amy and I began to work together. And then the first case I wrote up really about working with a person right near death, I decided I can do it because Amy's there, she sees it, and there's all sorts of other people around. And so coma work began, so to speak, at that time.
What an interesting, fascinating direction to follow. Now, somehow your work with individuals has evolved into working with groups. How did that transition happen?
Dave, it's all just the Tao. It's all just, you know, it looks like, and that's what I'd like psychology eventually to be, where all of us can say, yes, we're doing process work in one form or another, and it's human beings and human processes. So whether somebody's in a coma, I'm just following the process and the signal exchanges, the minimal cues and what have you, or large group work. Amy and I, it began in a way, Amy and I were in South Africa before the revolution in Cape Town, and we were talking about the dream body. And there were all kinds of people there in Cape Town, South Africa, and some came forward and they said, yes, but what about the pain and agony we're having here on the streets? Mm-hmm. And I said, gee, I'm a psychologist. I'm working with individuals and couples and families.
What if I go out in the street and I'm shot at, or I have to live in this political situation? I can't just afford to work on myself.
What good is the people say, what good does it do to me to work on myself? I go outside and get shot. So Amy and I started talking about that, and I went back to Zurich, and I talked to my friends and students and colleagues in Zurich, and said, we've got to develop World Work. And
World Work is the name of our large group. Work and conflict resolution.
And World Work is not just about then a small group, but yes, it does. It has an organizational part that works with small and large people sitting around a desk or in an organizational setting. No, it was developed by Dave in order to approach large groups of people who are irritated, upset, angry, or even fighting one another. Even dangerously fighting one another. In other words, psychology should be about dealing with people where they're at, whether they're in a coma or they're in an almost murderous situation. So that's how World Work began.
So what would you do in a large, emotionally charged, conflictual mm-hmm. group?
Mm-hmm. Maybe an example would be helpful
yeah.
about that.
Mm-hmm.
There's many, many different things. There's a whole lot of skills and what I call meta skills or the feeling skills of what we do. But right in the moment, I think of an example from, we were in Oakland. I forget what year that was. It was just before
1992 or 3, something like that.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. It was just before the verdict on the Rodney King trial came out, when the policemen were on trial for the beating of Rodney King. And
an African-American man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was, as you can imagine,
Los Angeles, yeah.
And we were in Oakland at the time.
I can imagine what that was like then.
I'm sure you can imagine, yeah.
Yeah.
And we came together, a colleague of ours, Wilma Jean Tucker, organized and facilitated the seminar with us. And it was a very large group of people, and there were policemen that were there also because they were very worried that a riot or something could happen. And everybody was worried about what would happen after the verdict came out. And I can feel the tension and everything as I say it, all of the emotion. And many things happened. At one point, there was a really, really very intense conflict.
Yes, imagine hundreds of people mm-hmm. standing around, and the African-American people are saying, you white characters, you're such a problem. You don't realize it. I'm saying it very nicely.
Yes.
And you can imagine, and then the people on the other side say, no, we're not all bad. What are you
white
doing to
saying,
us?
We didn't do it. It's not us. Don't talk to me about it.
We're innocent. We're good people. No, you guys don't know. You're just the rank and the power that you have, just because you're not even aware of the historic component of what you're doing. And people started to scream, and they were getting very, very angry at one another. And in the middle of all of this, suddenly, one African-American man started making sounds. Ooh, ooh, he said. And then, first he was very quiet. Then he gets louder. Oh, and he started louder and louder. Oh.
He started wailing, and he said, this is not black pain. This is not only white pain. It's all of our pain. When you hurt, I hurt too. And then he proceeded to almost wail.
Mm.
And there were hundreds of people, and one by one, people started to gather around in this large hall and formed, it's hard to describe, formed a large circle of people, and while he was wailing. And out of that wailing sound, then shortly thereafter, the African Americans begin to sing sacred songs of their own. And then, of all things, they asked, come on, you guys with European traditions and backgrounds, sing some of your sacred songs.
Now, were you there, quotes, leading this in any way?
were the facilitators.
Yes, we were the facilitators.
Because you kind of left yourself out of the story.
Right. I forgot about that. Yeah, we're encouraging people. How do you do that? We see things that are very, as we said before, secondary. That means nobody's, the whole group isn't identifying with that particular signal that's coming forward. This was like, we call that a ghost role. The role of, we're talking about suffering, but no one is directly showing the suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a ghost role in our terminology now, and that ghost role needs to be filled. It's a ghost of agony that is impossible for any really one human being to fill, but it's in a role in the field, in the larger, the pain that at the surface, more primary to everybody, was the anger and the upsetness and the fear. And it's more secondary in the background is the roles and ghost roles. One of the ghost roles was just the ultimate pain of it all. And by bringing up, again, the same thing in the process sense of bringing up what is there in the background, change, I'm making it simple because there's a lot of other signals and things we do, but the base studies, a change happens through that. And especially when there's a collision of opposites at the surface, something from the background has immense transformation powers. That's one example. We had another example like that in Ireland.
Yeah. Maybe.
Can we tell you another one?
Yeah, sure. I love
okay.
it.
Okay. We were in Ireland a number of years ago in Dublin, just before they voted on the peace treaty. And there were people who came together from the north and from the south, from the opposing parties there. And as you can imagine, also it was extremely tense. And
Dave knows about that. Have you not worked there, Dave?
Yes, I have worked in Ireland. That's one of the places where they said, and do you know Arnie Mandel's work?
Well,
maybe that's why we're coming back to it.
Yeah,
then, right?
that may be. Yeah. So go ahead with the story.
No, go ahead.
No, you were in the midst of a story, weren't you?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And again, to make a long story short, at one point in the large group process, there were two men who were kind of really, really angry with each other. One was from the north, one was from the south.
Politicians, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they were enraged. They were screaming. One side was screaming that I was in a pub and we got blown up and I survived and a lot of people didn't. And the other side was saying, well, so many of my relatives have been killed and it's your fault. And it got very, very, it started to escalate. And I remember, Arnie, you saying at one point, because people were getting nervous, trust these men. They're going to know how to deal with this together. And that brings a kind of awareness that, to what's happening, that things can actually go further.
That's a great sort of meta message there.
Yeah.
It's a meta message, and it lets the group as a whole be quiet, and the two particular contestants then can channel the energies in the group. So the man from the north and the man from the south were really yelling at each other, almost screaming at each other, and everybody, though they were gave them room in the center to follow this, was while focusing on that, everyone started to scream at the same time, and then suddenly I remembered my own training. Signals, Arnie, remember signals. And I looked in, and what signals am I seeing these men doing? And I saw the neck of one of the men. The signal that was standing out most to me was not his yelling, but an extremely red neck. It all blotched, and red blotches all over. And I said to him, from the outskirts, we were facilitating from the outskirts of the circle, looking inward, I said to him, your red neck, the red neck, the redness there. And he stopped suddenly, and he said, my doctor told me not to come today. I had a heart attack a couple of weeks ago. He said, I'm crazy to come here.
And then right away, the man on the other side said, well, my doctor told me not to come either, because I have lethally high blood pressure that could be very dangerous for me to come and to get very upset.
And then I said, death. And they both looked at each other. It's hard to hard to believe. Mm-hmm. They both looked at each other, and slowly, one man walked slowly around to the other man, and he said, "Death," and he put his arm around
the other man,
his contestant. Yeah. And they stood side by side, and everybody got quiet. And these men walked then to the edge of the circle, and everybody was quiet. And after that, everyone could sit down and start talking about how do we get along together.
I feel emotionally moved just hearing that story. I can imagine what a moving moment that must have been.
It was extremely touching. It's one of those special moments in life.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap this up. You know, I could go on talking with you two for hours. Let me ask you one last question, which is, what do you see for the future of your work? What's on the horizon?
Amy, what do you think?
I think there's many things. One of the things that I'm particularly interested in, again, coming back to my background, is creativity. I wrote a book about process work and creativity and how we can use some of our psychological ideas that we use in therapy to enhance and bring forth our creativity, not just look at its psychology, but as a furthering of our artwork and the creative, dynamic, dreaming force that's happening inside of us all the time. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in bringing that out more.
Amy, is that your work that I see on YouTube?
Yes, it is.
Because I did
that's
a search
me singing
there.
And,
yeah,
what's that?
I actually did a search there on your name.
Yeah, that's me.
I saw puppets and all sorts of little things there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And on my side, I think the future for me is understanding more about the Tao that can be said and trying to get along and follow the Tao. And I've been using in recent years, my quantum physics has been very helpful. And non-locality goes back to the mind of God again. What is the intelligence in our universe moving us and moving everybody? What is there? Is there a mind back there? And is it a very intelligent one? Sometimes it seems like as they say in German, a Dummkopf. It's a little, seems a little silly, that mind. But I think it's not, and I want to find out more about it.
Wonderful. Well, Amy and Arnie Mandel, thanks so much for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much.
What a pleasure.
It was wonderful.
You do a lot for people, and we want to thank you personally, not just for us, but for other people. That you do a lot for the world. Thank you, Dave.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Drs. Arnold and Amy Mandel as much as I did. Well, it all still sounds like magic to me. The thing that I'm most impressed by, though, is the way these two are able to work together so effectively and the tremendous amount of positive energy they project. I felt so high and energized myself by the end of the interview. So how could that be anything but healing? I think their enthusiasm and energy and the loving acceptance of the people they work with must be the secret sauce. And if it were possible to bottle that, I'd buy a bucket of it at least. At this point, I'm pretty much retired from applied work, but even so, I find myself tempted to sign up for their training program. Don't you just want to get closer to all that good energy? Once again, you can learn more about the Mandels by going to our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com, where you'll also find a link to their website.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. Dr. Dave is here to remind you it's all in your mind.
Hey, it's back to school time. Here's wishing all you students and professors and school counselors a great semester. And while I'm at it, Please remember to let folks at your school know about Shrink Wrap Radio. There's even a flyer under the promos menu on our website that you can print out and hang on bulletin boards at your school. Or you can stand in the middle of the quad and hand out flyers. Or how about making a sandwich board and walking around with that? But I'm getting carried away. In that same vein, I'm always very appreciative of any mentions or links from your blog or website. Enough said about that. I want to thank the folks at rawair.net for their $20 PayPal donation to purchase a link on our Top Spots widget. Be sure to go to our website and click on that link and find out more about their solution for dealing with the toxic gases that they say our computers are outgassing. They've even got a video on their site that explains the whole concept. They make the ninth sponsor who's chosen to make a $20 PayPal donation to help support Shrink Wrap Radio. And there's one more empty slot left. Won't you consider advertising your blog, your website, or your business service in that slot? For example, that support helped support me traveling to Las Vegas for the recent New Media Expo, where all the top podcasters gathered. It also helped me buy a new digital recorder for capturing better, high-quality, in-person interviews. By the way, speaking of the New Media Expo in Las Vegas, I forgot to mention last time that I had a lovely dinner with Shrink Wrap Radio listener, interviewee, and fellow podcaster Tom Barbalay and his wife Michelle. I got to see the real Las Vegas as they took me across town to their favorite Japanese restaurant, which was far away from the glitzy Vegas Strip. You can check out Tom's many activities relating to artificial life at www.biota.org. That's B-I-O-T-A. I should also mention that Tom has volunteered to reinvigorate our Shrink Wrap Radio fan club on Facebook. More about that in the future. He was also inspired by our Shrink Wrap Radio live series on Blog Talk Radio, to start doing his podcast there using their call-in facility, and it's worked out much better for him, really, than it did for Jerry and me. Tom was gracious enough to cite Shrink Wrap Radio in a chapter that he contributed to a book on artificial life, and I'm most grateful for that reference. I had acknowledged this as a first to Tom, but I subsequently remembered that I'm also quoted in Shrink Wrap Radio in Tricks of the Podcasting Masters by Rob Walsh and Muir Lafferty. I want to thank all of our volunteers for the great work on transcribing our interviews. There are so many transcripts available now, and they keep pouring in. Speaking of volunteers, I could really use the help of a devoted fan in submitting information about Shrink Wrap Radio to all the podcast directories out there. There are a ton of them, and it's a task that someone would need to plug away at, doing maybe 5 or 10 a day. If you have the time and energy to take this on, please drop me an email. There's a new poll on our site that no one has responded to yet. You have to scroll way down to the bottom of the page. It's in the right-hand gutter, and it asks the following question. If it were priced reasonably, would you be likely to subscribe to premium Shrink Wrap Radio content? For example, interviews that would not be available for free, transcripts, special compilations, etc. So please take the poll. Let me know your thinking on this important question. Okay, time for a contest. I'm looking for some new audio transitions. You know, you're on the couch with Dr. Dave or some other clever bits that might work well. They should probably be somewhere between 10 and 30 seconds in length, and either be in a WAV or MP3 format. You don't even have to have a fancy setup to do this, you know. You can use the phone number that I give at the end of the show, 206-337-0622. Although if you are able to create an MP3 or WAV file on your computer, the quality would definitely be better. Now, I'll choose among all the entries I receive up through the end of September 2008. And to the lucky winner, I'll send the book Artificial Happiness, The Dark Side of the New Happy Class by Ronald Dworkin, MD, PhD. Unfortunately, I can only offer the incentive of this prize to those in the U.S. It's just too expensive to send books internationally. But for those outside the country, you'll get the ego reward of hearing your transition played, even if you're not the big winner, as will everyone who submits a reasonable transition. As always, our sponsors are Mevio and GoDaddy. Remember to support this show by using the discount code of SHRINK3 for all your domain name purchases at GoDaddy.
Before I continue, I just wanted to say a shout-out to Dr. Dave of Shrink Wrap Radio. I forgot to mention last week's show, Dr. Dave is the origin of Biota Live. Obviously, his Shrink Wrap Radio Live was instrumental in starting Biota Live. I'm going to play a new promo from Dr. Dave at the end of this podcast, which is inspired by Bob Dylan, and my parents met at a Bob Dylan concert, so I have a particular connection with that. Dr. Dave is also referenced in the Dick Gordon Book Project, which is an interesting overlap because that's also the first time Shrink Wrap Radio has ever been referenced in a book of any form.
Thanks, Tom Barbalay, for sending that clip from one of your recent podcasts. As I said earlier, it turns out that's not the first mention of Shrink Wrap Radio in a book, but I certainly hope it's not the last either. Now on to a couple of listener emails. Thanks to Jack McShay for sending me a link to Psych Widget. This is a handy little tool that directs you to a ton of psychology resources on the web. Works on Macs, and there's a platform agnostic version that works on Yahoo. You'll find it at www.socialpsychology.org/widget.htm. So thanks again for that tip, Jack. Thanks also to regular listener Erno, who I believe is in the Netherlands, and who sent a link to a witty YouTube video about a psychotherapist. Do a search on YouTube for Our Time Is Up, and you'll find it. Anna the Man, our Israeli reviewer, dropped a note to say he's fallen terribly behind in his listening and reviewing, but he wrote a very nice review of show number 151 about relationships in the workplace on his blog, which you can find at annaisaman.blogspot.com, and Anna is spelled A-N-N-E. And finally, we conclude with one from Eric Patton, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. I recently discovered your podcast on iTunes and was immediately hooked. I'm a reluctant remodeling contractor in Davis, California by day and a newly empowered college student by night." Gee, Davis is not far from where I am. "Since returning to college, I've been trying to take on simple projects such as exterior paint and the like. This has given me the great opportunity to listen to interesting podcasts while I work. I came across your show about 2 weeks ago and have been listening to 5 or 6 episodes a day since the work I'm currently doing requires only a fraction of my attention. Although as a longtime meditator, I try to remain ubiquitously mindful in all I do. I especially liked your recent live episode number 161, where you and Jerry discussed whether or not Google reduces attention span. I have 2 main interests in my life, technology and consciousness, so whenever these 2 areas meet, you can be sure I will be listening keenly. I'm currently obtaining a degree in computer science with hopes of becoming a developer of biofeedback software, much like Wild Divine, although I can take the concept much further even with our current limited technology. As an aside, I don't know who Wild Divine is or what it is." He goes on to write, "But I digress. Although I had during the aforementioned discussion was that people may not, in fact, be developing shorter attention spans, but that we are able to glean more information from less material. I know that I spend a lot of time researching various topics and cannot afford to spend too much time in any one place. I have, however, developed a new technique in this regard. Once I've tapped the relevant information from several sources and done a quick check on the author's credentials, I will go back and read the most relevant and/or interesting article in its entirety. To me, it's the best of both worlds. It's like warming up with several 100-yard dashes before running the marathon. By the way, episode number 163 also quite tickled my fancy. It seems that if I just jump in and start reading any random text, I end up wasting a lot of time in rerun perspectives and insincere fluff jotted by authors that write for a penny rather than a purpose. I like that phrase, write for a penny rather than a purpose. Perhaps the problem is not with attention, but with an inundation of poor content on a flooded internet. After all, we learned to surf because we needed a method to traverse a new ocean of information. As for the cloud connection topic, don't even get me started. Finally, I hope you like the transition piece attached to this email. The background music is from the first track of my own album, Only Guitar, which is available on iTunes if you think your listeners would be interested. Thank you so much for your beautiful contribution to the world of podcasting. I look forward to many new episodes to come. Who knows, maybe someday I'll make a large enough impact in the world of consciousness to be one of your guests. Until then, you can be sure you have a devoted listener. Sincerely, Eric Patton. P.S. If you're interested, I would love to send you a copy of my album, Only Guitar. Just let me know where to ship it. Well, I was interested and sent him my address, and he very kindly sent me a copy of the CD. And as a matter of fact, I will play a track from that CD to close out our show today instead of my usual ending. And I did play that transition that he sent on the last show. So, Eric, I do look forward to interviewing you once you've completed your graduate studies in consciousness. I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember, you can leave comments about individual shows. You can leave voicemails on Skype. You can use the My Chingo button to make a recording. You can leave voicemails on our phone at 206-337-0622. Don't forget about those transitions. Now, thanks again to Drs. Arnie and Amy Mendel for sharing their pioneering world work. My next guest will be Dr. Thomas Murray, who directs a university counseling center. I hope you'll join us for that show. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.